So thank you very much to Aaron for setting everything up. I can promise that this will be a similar topic and a model that is not as good. So this is work with my colleague Anson D'Aloisio at UC Riverside and our shared student Yash. So like Aaron, everything that is useful and interesting and great about this talk is from Yash. Everything that is flawed and horrible is because of me and me forcing Yash to teach me everything. Also, special thanks to Katie and Sarah, who's been mentioned several times over this conference, for really getting me thinking about this a few years ago. All right. So yeah, let me be very upfront about where we are. We don't have a great working model. I think at the time that we wrote the abstract, we might have thought that we had one. This is the picture that I show our undergrads at UC Riverside when they ask, why should I be doing my homework? And the punchline is that we will be interested in 10, 20 MeV dark matter annihilating into electrons and inverse Compton scattering and giving us these Wernher photons we learned about. And at the cross sections that we're looking for, it turns out we're ruled out by this goddamn space probe that was launched in 1977. It turns out that so the analysis of E plus E minus injection from Voyager was just 5 or 6 years ago. I've since learned that the instrument on Voyager that was taking this data, so the killer app was that they left the heliosphere. The instrument that was taking this data broke a few years ago. And so there's an alternate reality where it broke a little bit earlier. And then you say, flip, you know, don't wish ill on science. But turns out Voyager has a twin. There's a Voyager 2 that will be sending data in the coming years. So in honor of Aaron. Yeah. So in honor of Aaron, you know, I'm, at the end of this talk, I'm going to ask for better models. These are not the models you're looking for. We have seen this plot zillions of times. I'm putting it up only because it has all of the buzzwords for this conference, this wonderful conference that we have. We will be right here. I guess we're at what they call first stars, not first light. And this is from NASA. NASA has this era of dark matter, which I thought the point was dark matter was here the whole time. But what's great about this window is that this is the perfect laboratory for indirect detection. We're talking about a time when halos were collapsing. The dark matter number density was shooting up. The annihilation rate of dark matter annihilates is shooting up. And the universe is very quiet. As far as the products of indirect detection are concerned, this is as quiet as it gets. And so the killer app is the looking for the supermassive black holes. These are 10 to the 9 solar masses at around redshift 7. The puzzle, as Aaron framed it, is that the size of these black holes is larger than you expect from Eddington scale accretion. I'm going to shout out Priya Natarajan, who's another person who I learned a lot about this from. And this is a cute Scientific American article that has all the right graphics. So the usual way in which black holes are formed are that you have a halo. So a halo pops three stars. One of them becomes a black hole, and they start eating its neighbors, and then small black holes become big black holes. And there's a limit to how fast that process can occur. So to explain these supermassive black holes, one alternative is what Aaron pointed out. It might be that you have this gas which directly collapses into a seed black hole at early redshifts. And the way to do that is you have to inject Lyman-Werner radiation. And a standard model or standard astronomy explanation is maybe you have starlight that is shining this Lyman-Werner to neighboring halos and causing the H2 to dissociate, which changes the gas chemistry and allows the gas to collapse without fragmenting. So yesterday we had these great talks about complex dark sectors. And you know, I was being triggered in the morning when everyone talked about, like, look how complicated fragmentation is. And the whole name of the game in this business is you don't want things to fragment. So this is the complement of yesterday. So here is a different way of telling the story that Aaron told. It's the exact same story. In these early proto-halos, you have this choice. You pick the red pill or the blue pill. So you start out down here in the bottom left, and your halo gets bigger and warmer up to the top right. And if you have molecular hydrogen, if you have H2, what happens is you start heating up because you are compressing your gas. And at some point, because of H2, you rapidly cool. And as you cool down, you're able to get to hydrogen line cooling. But the fact that you have this H2 operating down to about 200 Kelvin gives you a rapid drop that loitering period, this bounce over here, is what causes fragmentation. And these diagonal dashed lines here, if you look at the minimum of this curve, that tells you roughly the scale of the fragments that form during this process. So we don't want that. I think there's a black line over here. The black line is what you have when you have metals. So that's also not the regime we're in. We're looking at the first stars. So this is what happens for POP3 stars. We don't want that. If you want to form these direct collapse black holes, which is our target, you would like to continue compression heating all the way up to around 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And this is when hydrogen line cooling kicks in. And the difference is that the hydrogen line cooling is much smoother. So you don't have this bounce that causes fragmentation. And let's see. If you hit this zone of no return, so it's not that in this plot there's here is your direct collapse black hole. But if you hit that zone of no return in your trajectory, then our metric is you're reasonably sure this thing will turn into a direct collapse black hole. The name of the game is, can you have this happen with dark matter? Oh, I have controls, don't I? So this is the exact same story in a flowchart. You have a sufficiently large proto-galaxy that's sufficiently hot. If it's not hot enough, you might form these little POP3 black holes. This is a pristine gas. You think, what a great place for direct or for indirect detection. If you have no H2 cooling, perhaps because you have enough of a flux of Lyman-Verneau photons that you blow away all of your H2, then you can form a supermassive star that turns into a sufficiently large 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole at redshift z of 10 to the 12-ish. Otherwise, you go down the POP3 star route and you get smaller black holes. Again, can we have dark matter do this? So our key player is molecular hydrogen. It's our coolant. This is, again, saying the exact same thing, right? Here, you recognize molecular hydrogen, proton, proton, electrons. This is our main character. This is the thing that's critical for whether or not you pick the red pill or the blue pill. And so because you're choosing between the red pill or the blue pill, it's important to know, how did this character get here and how do we get rid of him or her or it? So one pathway, and let's take the simplest pathway for forming molecular hydrogen, is exactly what Aaron shared with us. It is catalyzed by the presence of electrons. So you have your hydrogen atom. It picks up a stray electron. It forms H- and radiates some energy. Later on, this H- bumps into a hydrogen atom, and they kiss. And this extra electron goes on its merry way. The electron's like the matchmaker. It's the catalyst. I only mention this because this gives you some guideline that if you are putting in more electrons into your environment, you are helping create the bad guy being H2. We can get rid of H2 by dissociating. So you hit it with this roughly 10 eV photon, and the two hydrogen atoms fall apart. And there's also a photo detachment we learned from Aaron. Okay, so those are the two, for the purposes of this talk, those are the two main processes. So the goal is, let's have dark matter help us. So if dark matter is around 20 MeV and annihilates into electrons, you're injecting 20 MeV electrons into your pristine early proto-galaxy. At these energies and in that pristine environment, the thing that these electrons do is they inverse Compton scatter off as a CMB light. And we have chosen 20 MeV such that the peak of the scattered photons are going to be exactly in this Lyman-Verneau range. And if you have this, if you turn off H2 cooling in a 10 to the 6 solar mass halo at around z of 25, then that seems to be the target that you want to get to have atomic cooling at Z of roughly 12 to go down the red path, you know, take the red pill and produce direct collapse black holes. And I was very happy that we had this great discussion about self-shielding, because this is the main issue, right? The moment that you let any H2 build up, then our efforts fail. Because what are we doing? We're injecting electrons into this environment. So we're doing something, from the point of view of doing the thing that we want, we're doing something very dangerous. We're producing the thing that we don't want, right, in order to get the thing that we do want. And this is why this becomes a bit of a tricky business. So there are many great analogies for this, you know, storming the Bastille, or you know, the nomads breaking into the Great Wall, like this self-shielding. Because there are so many people in this room who know much more about this than I do, my favorite analogy is from Planet Earth, or sorry, Frozen Planet. There's a clip called Criminal Penguins. So if you already know everything I'm going to talk about, just watch this clip. It'll enrich your life. But this is a penguin who is building a nest. This is the shield. And this penguin goes around looking for just the right pebbles to build its nest. OK, that's not what we want. This is us. This is the criminal penguin. This is the model builder who's thinking, I don't want that nest to be built. So every time this penguin goes to go find the perfect pebble, this penguin hops over and steals one of those pebbles and takes it away. That's the game that we're playing. Because the moment that this nest is done, that penguin sits down there and watches. And you can no longer steal pebbles, and you have self-shielded your Halo. All right? It is a very good clip. It'll just uplift your soul. So what are we doing? We are picking a slow-growing Halo. So there are many different Halos in the early universe. Let us pick the ones that are sufficiently slow-growing. So here's the Halo growth. This is apparently something that, you know, you take your bag of Halos, and you pick one of them, and there's a good chance it'll be roughly in this range. We've picked the numbers such that you hit exactly these targets that we were talking about. That I don't think is a tuning or a particularly obtuse choice. We are also picking a slow-growing Halo because this avoids the effect of dynamical heating. And so Wenzer's talk will tell us a lot about the, you know, what happens when you have more energy injection and when all of this gets more complicated. We wanted to keep things relatively simple. But I think, in principle, adding more heating is probably a good thing. But I can't say that with absolute certainty. But what's nice about removing the heating is we're really isolating the effect of dark matter energy injection. We model the hydrogen gas as an isothermal halo. This is valid, because as long as you don't have H2 cooling, your gas is staying at the same temperature. And anyway, the moment that this assumption is violated, it's not that the you know, oh, I have to model it better, it's that you're dead. Like, you've lost the game. You're on the blue path. You're self-shielding, and that's the end of your path. All right. So frequencies now matter. I just gave you this motivation that the, you know, the ideal thing, like what Aaron was saying, is how do you beat self-shielding? You know, maybe the call is coming from inside the house. I don't know how many times I told Yash, like, you know what, the game that we're playing is the call is coming from inside the house. That's how you beat self-shielding. It turns out that's not the case in this model. That's not the case because a 20 MeV electron, for a 20 MeV electron, the halo is actually very optically thin. So these electrons leave the halo and propagate quite a bit. That's OK, not OK, I don't know. Maybe it's good that these electrons are leaving this region where we want to have limited H2. The CMB photons are all over the place, so it scatters off a CMB photon in inverse Comptons. There's some 4 pi isotropic distribution. Some of that will shine back down. The Lyman-Werner photons will make it back. So sorry, the Lyman-Werners also see the hydrogen gas as optically thin. So that's good. We have a source of Lyman-Werner photons. Unfortunately, it's now coming back from outside the house. This thing also produces higher energy states. And that is a headache. Right? That makes things more difficult. And then we can ask Wenzer what happens. That'll be after the break. But what's nice about this is that the higher energy final states, well, one, they will ionize the gas in the IgM, and it will heat the gas. Heating might be good. Ionizing is definitely bad. But that happens outside in a region that is optically thick to these secondary products. So the story that, we were hoping for, well, that, turns, I think, to be true, is that these final states, the ones that are not the Lyman-Verner photons that we want, get stuck in the IgM outside the halo. Another point is that one should check that everything we've assumed is that the halo is the dominant source of energy injection. So this is something that you might be used to from indirect detection, where, yeah, of course, you have this J factor. You have this rho squared factor. It is not obvious. And again, in, the paper that will be presented after the break, this can break down. Certainly, in the case of decaying dark matter, it breaks down. But I believe we are reasonably sure that the halo contribution for this story dominates that from the IgM. Now, what's nice about this model, in as much as it doesn't actually work, but what's nice about this model is that it is now a relatively simple problem. Right? We know exactly what energy range we're in. We don't have to worry too much about the higher energy stuff. And we're in an environment where there's no B fields and the environment's pretty simple. And our electron transport problem is linear and solvable. And so we asked Yash to solve it, and you can solve it analytically. The closed form is not too bad. And now you can actually track things like what happens with the self-shielding in a bit more quantitative way. And okay, so here is a plot. On the x-axis is the distance from the center of the halo. On the y-axis is the energy of the, electron. The point here is that we can treat the, halo as a point source of these electrons. That is because the radius of the halo is around here. You can see a red line, which is kind of the outline. That's the characteristic curve for solving the transport equation. Most of the electrons, their energy follows, is very close to this red line. So I removed the legend, unfortunately. But this is a density profile. Orange is where most of the, electrons are. So all through the edge of the halo, you basically have 20 MeV electrons. You're not losing very much energy. And it's only far outside the halo by orders of magnitude that these things really start to lose energy by multiple scattering off of starlight, giving you your Lyman-Verner.
And that's because there's not enough photons inside the halo.
This is just saying that the, environment is optically thin to the 20 MeV electrons.
It's counterintuitive that once you leave the halo, they have an easier time scattering.
Oh, it's just that it's been cooling. It propagates longer, and so now it,
it's the long scale.
Yeah, that's yeah. Sorry, that's all.
Sorry, is this the electrons when they do scatter?
Yeah, yeah. So what's happening as the electrons lose energy is that they're inverse Compton scattering off of starlight, and some fraction of that is shining back down to the halo.
Not
CMB. Sorry, CMB. Sorry. It is inverse Compton CMB.
But this is the equilibrium. In some sense, the equilibrium energy at CMB is that takes while the scattering.
Yeah. So each, I guess, if you take a slice along, how do I want to do this? If you take a vertical slice and plot this, this is an energy distribution. Yeah. These are being recorded, right? So Yash, if you're watching this, this is why I said you should make the plot that David just asked about. You should all hire him when he applies. He's fantastic. So the ionization history. So let's get back to the self-shielding question. Because we have a nice toy analytic model, we can see what happens. So x-axis is redshift, so we're moving forward in time this way. The y-axis is the ionization fraction, so how many electrons do you have in the halo? Not much is going on up till redshift 42, which is where we said, OK, this is when the gas starts accreting. So this is part of our toy model. And there's a little bump up here. So if there's no dark matter annihilation, the ionization goes down. With dark matter annihilation, this is a little bump going up. Now, why is it going up? I mean, I thought you said these electrons are basically leaving the halo. We care about the electrons in the halo. Well, as the halo is growing, it's accreting gas. And now what's happening is the gas that it's accreting, the environment that it's in, is now being ionized by our, electrons. So it's those electrons that are causing this bump in the ionization fraction. Why am I caring about the ionization fraction? Because now that I'm putting more electrons into my halo, I'm playing this very dangerous game where I could be encouraging H2 formation, not just discouraging it by dissociation. So we're playing this self-shielding game. And indeed, now let's get to the point. Again, x-axis is redshift. We're moving this way. The y-axis is the H2 fraction. That is our figure of merit. So there is a critical curve. So this is a different representation than the curves that Aaron has. But there's a critical curve where if your H2 fraction stays below the critical curve, you have dissociated enough molecular hydrogen that, as far as our model is concerned, you're plausibly going down the direct collapse red pill path. That's what you want. You want to stay below this thing. And the standard case is eventually you hit this, and then you form pop 3 stars. In our case, with some benchmark cross-section, it's looking good. You're below this. Oh, then you cross it. Oh, that sucks. And not only do you cross it, you jump up, and you get worse than the pop 3 case. And now we start to see why it got worse. Right? It got worse because you're injecting more electrons in. You're increasing H2 formation. And on top of that, the self-shielding is really killing you. Right? The moment you let it's like a revolution. The moment you let it, at some critical point, you can't keep it down. All right. So same game. Here's the critical curve. You want to stay under the critical curve. Because we have a nice analytical expression, you can start turning on and off terms. And there are 4 lines here, which are all trajectories. The bottom 2 lines, I've turned off the shielding effect. The upper 2 lines, the ones that take this horrible wrong turn into the bad region, these are the ones where shielding is turned on. The other pairs are whether or not you turn on ionization. What this is saying is ionization is not the thing that's really killing you. It's a self-shielding. Right? If the fact that you have self-shielding gives you this horrible little kink, it's like driving when you're inebriated. Not that I would know what that's like, but once you swerve, you're gone. Right? The thing that causes you to swerve is the self-shielding effect. And so the time that we spent talking about how important it is to model self-shielding, this is the key thing to worry about. So then we can say, okay, what does it take? Let's be optimistic. So this baseline critical curve, maybe there's some wiggle room. You know, maybe the fact that there's some relative velocity between the dark matter halo and the gas gives you a little bit of wiggle room. So let's put some order 1 factor. I suspect something more intelligent went to this factor of 6. I do not know that thing, nor am I that intelligent. But let's call this some plausible metric for wiggle room. And if we take a slightly relaxed curve, how big does our annihilation cross-section have to be to stay below this no-go line? And if you're optimistic, maybe 10 to the 2 times our benchmark, so maybe 10 to the 28 centimeters cubed per second, might be enough if you're willing to, you know, pray to the voice of the room and say maybe the universe is kind. Then you can start doing some model building. And so you can say, well, what do you need? The sub-GeV dark matter models are kind of interesting. So let's see if we can have a dark sector with a mediator. Right? This is a good way to get a thermal relic. And we look at what for a dark photon model, we look at what the exclusions look like and say, oh, you know, that's right. The CMB is kind of difficult. But something interesting is happening here. This red line here is your thermally produced dark matter. This gives you the correct dark matter abundance, even though I know we decided yesterday this is not something we're going to make a big deal about. But what's happening here where the line goes vertical is that you're hitting a resonance. You're hitting an S-channel resonance where the mediator is very closely tuned to twice the dark matter mass. And you can decide how much you want to live with playing that tuning. But this might be helpful. We thought it was going to be helpful. And here are 3 different lines. For this scenario, the 3 lines correspond to increasing levels of really tuning the spectrum. And what happens is there are 3 time regimes you might care about. Freeze out, when you're setting your thermal relic abundance, BBN, which sets an upper bound, and CMB, where you want to avoid spectral distortions. And with this resonance, as the universe cools down, maybe you're hitting the resonance somewhere, so you have a large cross-section, maybe to hit the target thermal freeze-out cross-section. And as you pass the resonance, you dip downwards. So you play limbo with the BBN bound. And what's more difficult is playing limbo with the CMB bound. So, oh, okay, well that's nice, but really the CMB bounds are killing you. Right, for S-wave annihilation, the CMB bounds are really killing you. You say, oh, that's a bummer. But that's okay, because I know that the CMB, the velocity on the CMB is actually very low for dark matter. And in halos, the velocity shoots up a bit. And so maybe that's what there's a standard trick for this. If the annihilation is P-wave, so it goes like velocity squared, then maybe we can suppress the annihilation at the CMB and still have a larger annihilation later on. And then we get back to this horrible 1977 space probe, which I only learned about a few months ago. And so for P-wave, you might be able to skirt the CMB bounds. But now Voyager 1 is killing you. And probably this green line over here is integral, X-ray lines. And that's also very problematic, because what are we doing? We are injecting electrons, and we're using inverse Compton to get a photon spectrum. And we were doing it for the CMB to get Lyman-Werner photons. But you can do the same analysis for starlight and the energy range to get our X-rays. And that's something now that integral can probe. So that's where we are here. There's one alternative. I don't know if it made it onto your slides, Aaron. This is the Plankton and Wales paper by our friends at UCLA. The idea here is that, again, it's the same game. You're playing with the gas chemistry early on, but now you're using Hawking radiation from a tiny subpopulation of little black holes. So here's the summary. I think my summary is the same as Aaron's. I'd love to hear better models. I'm looking forward to Wenzel's talk to tell us what happens when you have high energy deposition and all the complicated cascades you have to take into account. The current model is not quite working, but I hope that the actual modeling of the system helps shed some light, especially on the nature of self-shielding and how one should think about these problems. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes?
You just want this to be a contour for scattering photons and electric.
We did not do that, so I don't know. I don't think so, just from a numbers point of view. But yeah, I have not thought about that. Ben?
On that point, yes. The thing here is that the effective optic is changing as electrons with energy, right? So the ones that are just in the halo are probably not going to just scatter out the photons getting taken, right?
Right. Yes. Good. Good.
But back to the light. The spectrum over.
Yes. Did I overshoot? Sorry.
No. Yes, got it. Okay. So, okay. Without a color scale, I'm not.
Oh, yeah, sorry about this.
I see. Okay, right. So you're basically losing all the energy by the time you're at like a few hundred kiloparsecs.
Yes.
So, okay. So you probably can't. Well, actually, I don't know. Can you maybe do this between different halos?
I see. So you have a nearby halo, and
yeah, because like if you have, especially because I don't have much of a tool, I have to rescale everything. I know from z equals zero to z equals 40-ish, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem that crazy that you could have, you have scattered some background photons into
a neighboring halo.
Yeah, to the next halo.
So you just had. Well, 1.5 hours of me and Aaron saying how silly it is to have to hope you have nearby halos, but no, you are right in principle. So I have no idea what the population densities are like, whether that's plausible or why.
It's better than the other situation though, because you can have a whole cluster of them, and they're all doing this to each other.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You
could
have one star forming and one not.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be okay. All like that. You don't need any but as far as you have optics.
Are
you still dominated by the halo? Or should you see how something
good? Yeah, so.
You know, that's 1 ABB electron.
Good. Yeah, so we compared halo to IGM. We did not compare halo to nearby halos in the proto halo cluster.
So. It's, if I understood correctly, you have this parameter space where it seems like what kind of wants to happen is that you actually increase the amount of molecular hydrogen instead of decreasing it.
Where is that?
Sorry,
This one? Is it from here?
Further off.
I see. This one?
Yeah, even further, you showed like a few different lines.
Oh, yeah.
Like here. So your molecular fraction is actually like higher than you
know. Yeah, so, I mean, so everything above this line is bad.
But, well, it's bad from the perspective of trying to call our direct lab. But have you thought about, you know, if you turn that around, there are potentially interesting consequences.
Oh, I see.
Star formation if you have like 100 or 1,000 times more molecular hydrogen in there.
Yeah. I believe this is part of the theme of Wenzer's talk right after the break. Yeah.
Yes. You have Voyager constraints, so what exactly are you doing this?
I am doing nothing but crying. But yeah, so
what is that?
I can give you the broad stroke sketch. What I understand is that so Voyager passed the heliosphere not too long ago, and that's why this is all happening now. And so I think you avoid the chaos of the heliosphere, and I think there is still some remnant acceleration, reacceleration of the electrons, which makes them more observable.
So yeah, in principle, you're measuring the interstellar cluster frequency. Mm-hmm. There's all that you do. But like, what you expect does still depend on what your injection and propagation model is. And it's many MeV, you don't know about.
Confident that they know what's going on? Like, you could have a local
source. Well, I guess they don't have a local source.
Yeah, so this I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think there might be some uncertainty there.
Good. They have some bookending of a couple of different models that they use for propagation and a few assumptions about what your spectrum is. I believe this might be the conservative one.
Like, yeah. I'm not sure what that goes to.
Those
papers would be
they
would have done a load of
different computation
models. The other one is integral.
Yeah, these are for X-rays.
Right. So you mentioned inverse Compton, but I think you would get a very strong constraint just from the positron, the 500 KeV line, and that positron.
Okay.
And you would also get a constraint from internal branch problem, which you produce your plus or minus, you get a gamma ray offshoot that integral doesn't really see. You're injecting very dangerous electrons in the galactic center where we don't see a continuum above 500 KeV.
I see.
Interruptions.
Okay.
But then I don't think anyone's done the P wave there. We could.
Yeah, you're saying if we want to keep killing this thing, we can. There's some new constraints to contribute.
Yeah, I can email that with some Chris.
How local is the Voyager measurement?
This I have no idea.
Yes. No, obviously it's just sitting there and it's got your time, right? It's literally directly measuring these electrons, local. So to what extent is that dependent on sort of like very local density structure of dark matter? Like, is it possible that Voyager 1 pops out the other end and sees the other measurement? Like, I have no idea.
On that scale, it's probably fine.
On that scale, it's probably very bad.
I don't think your
20, 40 MeV electrons go very far.
Right.
So I guess, say you're in a local...
Even the dark matter has such a big development. Like, on these very small scales, I don't know if there are actually bounds on the very low.
Yes, they're all over maybe a kiloparsec kind of scale.
Right.
Because the most local measurements of the dark matter density are the vertical motions or open motions.
So anything smaller than that could be quite high contrast.
Which is why direct detection experiments haven't seen anything.
I
don't think you really expect that, but is that an answer?
A question that I think.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that. We work out the events.
Right. just stellar folks, like local existence of stars flying around.
We'll
disrupt the
matter structure of stars a lot of that structure. So it's one of the funny things that you actually lose that structure inside galaxies. But you don't lose it outside galaxies.
What is the smallest dark matter over density that, assuming the flying, assuming the normal sort of flying about there, nothing that smells to that could survive stellar disruption? Could something as small as like 1 or 2 parsecs survive? Or
it depends on compact. Stars are parsec.
And then you have to be quite compact.
Doesn't this also depend on if you're thinking about those prompt cusp things that start really really early and have very steep density profiles? Those apparently can survive within halos to some degree, and those are quite small as well. So that also changes the picture. I don't know enough about that model.
Right.
I mean,
more than you, based on our discussion yesterday, but not that many.
Naive question. So have you thought about it? So I guess the other way to do this direct collapse is not to further dissociate, but maybe to prevent the formation of the H2 in the first place. So can you maybe remove the electrons from?
Remove the electrons?
Yeah. Instead of like.
Creating
the.
That I don't know. The chemist in the room, the dark chemist in the room. It sounds dangerous for all the other gas chemistry.
What are you trying to do with the electrons?
Yeah.
I'm just curious, maybe. So, yeah.
Could you remove electrons?
Because there are too many electrons and we've won the H2, maybe we can just get rid of those.
How?
Yeah.
Okay. What you're saying is like, turn on the diagram that you're using to make the electrons, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have that better electron absorber.
Yeah.
Then it doesn't need solid leaders for the rest of the gas chemistry.
Yeah.
Do that.
No, you need something that'll like,
So if you can absorb an electron and add just a, I know that's bad, right?
You're making it slower.
Then you have a chant that goes around.
Yeah,
all sorts of constraints. Yeah, and you have what's the reference crossing, the reference velocity?
Oh, good. I do not know. We can ask Wenzer.
Yeah, I forget exactly. I think you were using, what's the standard rate?
200 kilometers per second.
So it's either that or the normalized Mach 1. I would also have to go back to this.
You might be able to explain the integral power of KV signal. So you can tell them 30 something.
Yeah.
It's estimated.
Okie doke. So everyone should go to Wenzer's talk.